thinking better and thinking together about life's most important issues. A place to finally meet in the middle, to think freely and reasonably about the big questions of life. This is Thinker Sensitive. Welcome to Thinker Sensitive. I'm Ryan Ragazine, your host. I want to begin today's episode with a quote written by the acclaimed American director Terrence Malick and originally narrated by the actress Jessica Chastain. The nuns taught us there are two ways through life, the way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow. Grace doesn't try to please itself, accepts being slighted, forgotten, disliked, accepts insults and injuries. Nature only wants to please itself, get others to please it too, likes to lord it over them, to have its own way. It finds reasons to be unhappy when all the world is shining around it and love is smiling through all things. They taught us that no one who ever loves the way of grace ever comes to a bad end. I will be true to you, whatever comes. The film The Tree of Life, an Academy Award nominee for Best Picture in 2012, tells the story of a family in North Texas dealing with the loss of a son. The movie functions as a theodicy, grappling with the age-old question, why do bad things happen to good people? And how could a good and loving God allow his creatures to experience such pain and suffering? The movie draws a contrast between nature and grace. Brad Pitt, the father in the film, represents the way of nature, the will to power, as Nietzsche put it, the pursuit of dominion, the yearning for respect, the path of selfishness and objectification, merely using people and things for one's own personal gain, the way of the Philistine and the brute, the road to disenchantment. Jessica Chastain, the mother in the film, personifies the way of grace, the will to meekness, the pursuit of joy, contentment, and fulfillment, the yearning to give oneself up, to give oneself away to the world and for others, the path of selflessness and humility, the way of forgiveness and love, the road to wonder, awe, beauty, and enchantment. The oldest child in the family, played by Sean Penn, finds both of his parents, their memories, their legacies, warring inside of him. As both of these paths, the way of nature and the way of grace, are ever laid out before him as alternatives, as possibilities leading to two different ends and outcomes. Now a grown man, he never really came to terms with the tragic death that took place in his family when he was just a young boy. He lives in a modern world, demystified and demythologized. Technology and human advancement have robbed the world of its spirit, of its beauty and enchantment. His childhood, marked by the wonders of the physical environment, have now been replaced with the cold and lifeless austerity of modern architecture. The creature has triumphed over creation. Material has triumphed over spirit. Nature has triumphed over grace. And what was lost, the beauty and love of a mother, is now felt tangibly and tragically, in the life of a lost and aimless son. If you haven't seen the film before, I would really encourage you to take some time to watch it, even if you're not a super artsy person. At the very least, check out the trailer, which includes some of the words from the opening monologue that I quoted at the beginning of this intro. To say that it is awe-inspiring is an understatement. In preparation for this episode, I watched the trailer again, and it was hard not to be moved by it. I'm a poet and a spoken word songwriter. I've always been drawn to Terrence Malick's movies because he uses these aesthetic devices so powerfully in his films, often narrating spoken word poetry over sweeping and soaring compositions that make the heavens themselves tremble. Majestic artistic expressions that stir up the human spirit, that speak a word of transcendence to the human soul. From the mouth of living spirit to the ears of the human spirit. From the mouth of God to his highest creatures. These transcendent and creative devices remind us of what we are. They awaken us from our sleep, from a long night filled with disenchanted dreams, from a lucid nightmare devoid of meaning and hope. They bring back to our memories where we came from and where we are going. They open up to us the mysteries of life and death. They allow us to hear that gentle, ethereal, quiet call of eternity. Do you hear it now? Ever so faintly? A voice calling out from the distance, yet from within? Awake, thy weathered and weary soul. Won't you remember who you are? The Tree of Life is a movie about the problem of evil, the problem of pain and suffering in the world, which is something that we all experience tangibly in our lives. Terrence Malick's response to this problem is less philosophical and analytical and more artistic and aesthetic. His solution to the problem is to meditate, to reflect deeply on the immense beauty and goodness in the world. See, one of the answers to the problem of evil is the problem of beauty. As I have mentioned, the Tree of Life wrestles with that age-old question that has haunted so many people throughout human history. Why do bad things happen to good people? How could a good God allow his beloved creatures to experience so much pain and suffering? The Tree of Life is Malick's theodicy. The word theodicy derives from the Greek language. It is essentially a compound word, made up of the term theos, which means God, and the term dike, which can be translated as trial, judgment, or justice. When you put these two words together, you get the idea of justifying God, a justification of God's goodness in the midst of evil. The Tree of Life represents Malick's subjective and personal justification. He responds to that age-old question with his own question. Why is the world, the galaxy, the universe filled with so much beauty, splendor, majesty, awe, and wonder? And how could anything but a good and beautiful God create such a good and beautiful world? Malick's theodicy is a play on the book of Job, A curious book that has tripped up and puzzled many interpreters throughout the ages. As the ancient story goes, Job was a prosperous and righteous person, a friend of God. Lucifer, or whatever you would like to call the devilish figure in this narrative, approaches God and requests his permission to test Job's piety, faith, and loyalty, questioning the sincerity of Job's devotion and calling into question whether Job merely serves God for selfish reasons. In response, God grants the satanic figure's request. Job loses his family, his wealth, and his health. After the fact, and in the heat of it all, Job's wife tells him to just, quote, curse God and die, end quote. His friends come to him to offer their personal counsel. Some of it's wise, and some of it is not so wise. Most of it not so wise. Towards the end of the story, Job gives his final defense and questions God himself. The book closes with God's personal response to Job, who is soon healed, renewed, and restored. The Tree of Life poetically, and often wordlessly, expresses this divine response to the problem of evil. A response that focuses on the providential care of God over creation. But the actual response is worth reading on its own merit. So here goes. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, 'This far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves halt.' Have you ever given orders to the morning, or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light, and their upraised arm is broken. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know. For you were already born. You have lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm to water a land where no one lives, an uninhabited desert, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Can you loosen Orion's belt? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, "Here we are"? Who gives the ibis wisdom or gives the rooster understanding? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for a lack of food? We don't have time to read the full response of God to Job, but do these words not inspire awe and wonder? Do they not testify to the splendor and majesty of the universe? Do they not recall the mysteries of life and remind us of the enchantment of the world? When you hear these words, does it not feel as if God Himself was speaking to you? This episode is not so much about the problem of evil. It's about the problem of beauty and goodness. More than that, it's about the problem of the loss of awe and wonder in the modern world. Like the oldest son in the Tree of Life, we've strayed from the way of grace. We've become disillusioned, demystifying and demythologizing reality with our pragmatic, cynical, and pessimistic modern sensibilities. Our advancements and our progress have driven spirit out of the world. We've become numb to the miraculous and supernatural nature of the cosmos, rationalizing away its spirit-filled enchantment. What is wondrous and mystical is made to be prosaic and commonplace by a flippant and unthoughtful acceptance of its normalcy. We live on a circular object or a round rock that is floating in an unfathomably vast space of outer darkness. And we're so desensitized to our reality that we're like, "Oh yeah, that's normal. Nothing to see here. Nothing odd about that. This chicken sandwich is really good. I wonder if I could make this at home." The mysteries of life, the miracles of reality, are staring us in the face, and we're completely blind to it. I think technology is a huge part of the problem. As great as it is, and as easy and convenient as it makes things, it steals our attention. It moves us from the majestic to the mundane. It keeps us tied to the banalities of life, robbing us of the sense of awe and wonder that comes through reflecting on the mysteries of the world. This has dampened the human spirit, numbing the soul, and dimming the light of grace inside all of us. Some of the practical effects of this I've previously discussed. The suicide rate. Spikes in mental illness. A loss of respect for the dignity and sacredness of human life. As moderns, we scoff at the religious sensibilities, the cultic practices, the superstition, and the mysticism of primitive man, making gods and idols out of nature. But one of the things that I admire is that these early people groups had a sense of spirit, soul, and the divine. As distorted and incomplete their worldviews may have been, in the absence of the distractions of technology and the conveniences of modern life, they looked out at the beauty and wonder of the universe, and they instinctively inferred that such splendor must be the product of something greater than themselves. Something worthy of glory, honor, and worship, and something that also resided inside of them. It was the Greek philosophers who took this intuitive ancient sensibility and tweaked it and formalized it in a logical and coherent manner, especially Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, who moved the Greeks away from polytheism. The great monotheistic religions then took the work of the Greek philosophers and augmented it, refined it, and fleshed it out even more. I think people need to be more romantic about life. And one needs to be intentional about sparking that romance and keeping it alive. Listening to this episode, you might think that I'm a modern mystic. I suppose that's true to a certain extent. Part of that is because I believe that I've experienced God in powerful ways throughout my life. And I think one of the reasons for that is because I've opened up my heart to transcendence, to something that is greater than me. In some sense, I've sought after God. And I do believe that if you seek, you will find. I tend to approach the world with a sense of awe and wonder. When I travel or hike or look out onto the horizon or sit on the beach and listen to the waves rumble and crash endlessly, as if they were a mirror into eternity. An analogical and temporal reflection of the infinite and the absolute. When I'm in nature, when I'm awake in the world, I have a sense of spirit in me and around me, a sense that I'm in the presence of God, that God is revealing himself to me, or even speaking to me through his vast and wondrous creation. I see God everywhere, in all the beauty of the world, his marks and fingerprints on all created things, including you. Thanks so much for listening. This episode, and all episodes of Thinkersensitive, are available on thinkersensitive.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app today to listen to more thought-provoking content from Thinkersensitive.